So we're going to finish up chapter 5, and then we'll get into 6. Okay, so temporal contiguity. So what were we talking before? Response, reinforcer, contingencies, arriving at the causal relationship. Non-contingent leads to, breakdown stuff. Okay, so we also need, besides the contiguity in terms of our response or outcome, we can look at this in terms of the timing as well. Generally speaking, the sooner you can have a response made and then give the outcome, the easier it's going to be to associate. The stronger that connection is going to be. Do the response, and then blah, 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 time passes, and then something, an outcome occurs. Well, what was that for? As Carolyn was showing there, right? So, that you can mark these things. You mark it, and then those also called bridging. It helps go. Oh, you just did something, and outcome's coming. Just wait for it. Here it is. That was it. We didn't miss it. Okay. So and the longer you go, if there's a big pause there, right? Maybe your subject does something else, which is not what you wanted them actually do. It's like, oh, you did the right thing. Oh, too late. Didn't catch it. You can get into forgetting problems. You can get into issues of reinforcer devaluation. We'll come back to that in a subsequent chapter, so just keep that one in mind here. Good old B.F. Skinner has a little bit to say on this. So, Skinner did all kinds of slightly wacky things there. We saw his we saw this not working. Wait, that was no. Which of these? Congratulations, I've apparently won something. Skinner and teaching. Oh, there it is. Okay. We saw his trying to get pigeons to fly missiles, sort of thing. In one of the earlier videos, we saw a little clip of this. Most of this I don't really care about, but he has a little bit in here where he talks about temporal contiguity and immediateness of reinforcement.
In a new way, passing following, there is much as well be a arithmetic or algebra or grammar, or in fact anything involving the use of words or symbols. Each student is using a teaching machine, a device which creates vastly improved conditions for effective study. What are teaching machines?
Some people hated Skinner. I mean, just loathed the man with a nearly irrational passion because they felt he was trying to turn people into things like pigeons and rats. It's like you put a rat in a chamber and it presses a lever, and now you're trying to do this with children. And it wasn't the case at all. He really just thought this was a more effective, efficient way, a more controlled way for letting children learn things. And he really thought there was good reasons for it. He wasn't trying to dehumanize, although certain humanist social science critics thought that, accused him of this. So, we go back to Watson with little Albert, and we've got this thing where the behavioral psychologists and the general public, or even other areas of academia, just keep butting heads on stuff. Anyways, I'm sorry, I digress.
How are they used? What can they teach? Who prepares the material they teach? And how does this material differ from textbooks, lectures, and educational television?
I also have no idea why the subtitles are in, I think, Spanish or something. Esperanto. I have no idea, but anyways.
What impact will machine teaching have on school organizations? Some of these questions can be answered in at least a preliminary way.
So here's Skinner himself.
I'm B.F. Skinner, professor of psychology at Harvard University. I should like to discuss some of the reasons why studying with the help of a teaching machine is often dramatically effective. With the machine you have just seen in use, the student sees a bit of text or other printed material in a window. This may be a sentence or two or an equation in arithmetic. Some small part is missing, and the student must supply it by writing on an exposed strip of paper. His response may be the answer to a question or the solution of a problem, but generally it is simply a symbol or word which completes the material he has just read. As soon as the student has written his response, he operates the machine and learns immediately whether he is right or wrong.
Okay, so you make your response, and then you check right away, and you see whether you got it right or wrong. So there's a close temporal contiguity here between making a response and figuring out what the outcome is.
This is a great improvement over the system in which papers are corrected by a teacher, where the student must wait perhaps till another day to learn whether or not what he has written is right. Such immediate knowledge has two principal effects. It leads most rapidly to the formation of correct behavior. The student quickly learns to be right. But there is also a motivating effect. The student is free of uncertainty or anxiety about his success or failure. His work is pleasurable. He does not have to force himself to study. A classroom in which machines are being used is usually the scene of intense concentration. One function of a teaching machine then is to give the student a quick report on the adequacy of his response.
Okay. Anyways, that was mainly what I wanted you to see out of this here. That was the sort of idea that Skinner had behind some of these devices, was to give that immediate kind of feedback. This is one thing. In multiple choice exams, the standard ones that we use is where you just fill in your bubble, and then at some point later you find out whether you are right or wrong. There's actually a better type out there. We unfortunately can't do them here on our campus. We need a special new optical scoring system. But they're like a scratch off. So, like the lotto scratch cards or these sort of things. So it's like, I think it's A. And if it's A, it'll say correct, right there, star, check mark, or a little Y underneath it. And you get 1 point for that answer. If it's like A, oh no. Second choice, C. If C is correct, it's like, yay, correct. You get like a quarter of a point. But you get the immediate feedback right then in the exam. Were you right or wrong? Okay, you still get some point. It's like, oh, C, no. B, if B is correct, right, you get like a tenth of a point for the question. It's like, no, oh, well, I wonder maybe if it's D. At that point, it has to be D. You get zero for that question. But what's nice about that system, and Brock University uses it and a few others, is that you get that immediate feedback. And you learn right there. And actually studies show that students that get questions wrong in a midterm, and then you put the same question back in on the final, if you do it this way, they're much less likely to get it wrong on the final. If you do it the way we do it here, just you don't get your feedback until you find. So even if they go and check their exams and look it over and see what the right answers were, they're still more likely to pick exactly the same answer they did on the final as they did in the midterm. They still get it wrong. And they get it wrong the same way. So, yeah. Anyways. Okay. So bridges and marking. We've already seen beautiful demonstrations of that today. Control. In instrumental conditioning, we set up this situation, hopefully, and it's going to work better if a response actually executes control over the outcome. If there's a case where you do this and that causes this, what becomes very stressful, actually, and at least difficult learning situations, but it can produce a lot of stress in animals, is uncontrollable situations where something's going to happen and you just don't know what it is. It's particularly bad if the outcome is something aversive, but even like appetitive things can be stressful. Surprise parties, I think somebody might be planning something. I don't know. Is it coming? Is someone going to throw me a surprise birthday party? You're not sure. Even that can be kind of stressful. But it's especially bad with aversives. So even if it's on more of a fixed schedule, that's not good. But randomly occurring aversive things, consider cases where you might have a child in an abusive family environment where step-parent just randomly at some point abuses the child, extremely stressful. No way to prepare, no way to know what's going on, no way to know really what caused. And in many of these cases, if you've got abusive adults towards children or spouses, there wasn't anything that caused the abuse. It just randomly happened. physiologically, very, very stressful. That can lead into learned helplessness, where you come to realize that your response has no control over the outcomes, and that generalizes, and then you just stop trying to make any sort of responses. Analogously to depression. Your textbook talks about triadic design in terms of setting up learned helplessness studies. So group B, group Y, group R. So an exposure phase, group E, has an escapable shock. So we set our subject up. It does something, it can escape. So foot shock being delivered to the rat, if it presses a lever or hops in a wheel or does something, terminates the shock there. So start with an escapable shock in our group B. Conditioning phase, we go into escape avoidance. They have an escape avoidance learning paradigm there. Do something particular, and you can initially start by escaping, stopping it, but eventually you can cause the shock never to be delivered. And as the outcome, then we go and test. We find very rapid avoidance, and they're good. And they're actually also what we call immunized. By doing this setup, escapable shock first, and then going through, even if you put them into a case where they've got inescapable shock at a subsequent phase, they'll keep trying stuff. They're not as likely to develop a learned helplessness. Our group Y, it's our yoked group. In this case here, what happens are the group Y subject did as many shocks as the subjects in group E did. That's what we mean by yoked, so it's set up that way. But these shocks are inescapable. They have no control of it. They just get shocked. They have no idea why. Nothing they do is going to terminate these shocks. They're just going to get them. Put them into this, again, the escape avoidance procedure, and they've got a very hard time learning the avoidance. In other words, we've got learned helplessness setting in here. Group R, in this case here, they have a very distinctive, you know, the inescapable shocks are delivered in a very distinctive setting, very specific context cues. They're restricted to the apparatus. It's only in this place. Then they do their escape avoidance training in a completely different context, very different. Well, in this case, they can pick up the avoidance very rapidly. In that case there, it's like, oh, I'm only going to get these inescapable shocks under this particular discriminative stimulus. In this particular setting, then I can't do anything about it. But in a different setting, maybe I can. Yeah?
So when it does restrict the apparatus,
they're
still getting
Wait a second. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of something. Right.
They don't get
it. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of a really cool way to do this, which is not what your textbook talks about. Thank you. You're right. Sorry. No. Our group, here this is, I'm thinking of a different study. This is just their control. I'm sorry. Back up the tape. Right. I'm sorry. In the Damian's triadic design, they're restricted to apparatuses. Nothing happens. They're just sitting there, da-da-da, and then they go straight to the escape avoidance training, and then they have rapid avoidance because they got no background. But the cool thing is when you can establish stimulus control. We'll get to that in Chapter 8. So I'm thinking ahead here. But if you can give really distinctive stimuli, it says, you know, the bad stuff's going to happen to you, but only in this particular specific context, it's less likely to generalize. So we don't get that learned helplessness. So sorry about that. You're right. This is group R is just their control in this setting. Okay, so there's that. So generally here in terms of learned helplessness, ideas, behavior has no effect on the situation. You're going to generalize. It'll transfer to all kinds of other contexts. And again, in many cases, that may be because we don't have a good, the stimulus control has not been really narrowly set up there. Meyer and Seligman did scads of work on this through the 60s into the 70s. They took a look at all kinds of issues like motivational, cognitive, and emotional impairments. These all can factor in. A lot of people are kind of twitchy about talking about emotional impairments in the non-humans, but certainly if you want to apply this to the human context, we can certainly see that emotional impairments can be problematic. In fact, I mean, studying depression, and to come up with a model for human depression in non-humans is tough. Even after all these years, the standard is to establish learned helplessness through inescapable aversives, and set that up in a rat or a pigeon or a monkey or whatever, and that's used as a model for human clinical depression. And you can get a lot of parallels. So with humans and depression, we can talk about what are called situational effects, either specific or global. So the depression is linked specifically to one thing, or is just everything, full-blown clinical. Attribution, internal or external attributions. Are you failing at things because of something wrong with you, or is it because the whole world is out to get you? It's external to you. You can't control it. And time course comes into play, short-term or long-term. The longer either learned helplessness or depression has been in effect, the harder it is going to be to rectify and fix. And again, we can set that up with the non-human animal models relatively easy. So in that sense, you know, I mean, it may not be exactly the same thing as clinical depression in humans, but at least we have a model for testing some aspect of this and trying certain behavioral techniques to reduce the symptoms. Okay, so that was five. Okay, there's B.F. Skinner again. In chapter six, we switch into schedules of reinforcement and choice. So we can talk about our simple schedules. And this is stuff that should be pretty much a review. So we've got ratio and interval. Ratio just means it's based on the number of responses. So a certain number of responses must be made before you can get the outcome. Interval is based on time. A certain amount of time has to elapse before the potential for getting the outcome, let's just call it the reinforcer, is available. We can have fixed and variable. Fixed, a set number or a set time. Variable, it's random. Okay, so over a period of time, trial by trial, it's going to vary, but over the long term, you can get some sort of average. Our fixed ratio, most basic way of doing this is fixed ratio 1, FR1. Every time you do it, you get reinforced. Also called continuous reinforcement, so CRF. Okay, so our continuous reinforcement. The only thing that is continuous reinforcement is a fixed ratio 1 schedule. Any other kind of schedule, whether it's fixed ratio 2 or fixed interval 1 second or whatever, anything else by its very nature is going to involve partial or what we also call intermittent reinforcement. So you say, wait a minute, a fixed interval 1 second? It's like, you know, you just wait a second and you're stuck. Yeah. Okay, you wait a second, you respond, you get it. One response gets you your reinforcer. What if you respond in a half a second? Well, you get nothing. All that partial or intermittent reinforcement means is there is the potential for you to make a response and not get reinforced. Okay? That becomes significant in issues of extinction, which we'll get to in chapter 9, I think it is. Okay, so fixed ratio 1 is the easiest system to learn. It's also the easiest system to extinguish, which is why if you want to maintain a behavior and not have to keep giving the reinforcers, you want to start called stretching it out. So no longer reinforcing on every single response, which apparently was happening when I was jumping up and down along the side of the wall there. It's like, all right, don't click every time, maybe 1 in 3 sort of thing. Okay, so we're stretching that. The other thing with fixed ratio is we get post-reinforcement pauses. So the post-reinforcement pause. So you make your responding, very steady, tend to be quite rapid, respond, respond, respond. Get the reinforcer, then nothing. Take a little bit of a break. So on a cumulative record, it goes up. You get the reinforcer delivered, and then your line goes flat on the graph there for a while. Then you start responding again. Now, why? What causes a post-reinforcement pause on a fixed ratio schedule? One possibility is fatigue. You've been responding, doing whatever it is. Oh, you get the reinforcer, you are exhausted. Okay, you know, you look at it and you say, well, with relatively small, relatively low fixed ratio schedules, like, say, an FR-10, you get relatively short post-reinforcement pauses. With larger, higher schedules, you get longer post-reinforcement pauses. So, yeah, maybe you're just getting exhausted. Okay, but you can set up response contingencies where, really, you know, they're not all that fatiguing. Push a button, push a button, push a button, push a button, push a button. I mean, it's like, oh, my finger is so tired. I just can't keep doing this. It's not that fatiguing, right? And yet we still, so even though we've got relatively low fatigue, or, you know, you can play with things like, okay, let's put some different resistance on the button. So, you know, at a low FR10, it's really hard to push the button. Okay, and then for an FR100, we reduce the resistance, so it's a lot easier. So in other words, we can actually standardize this in terms of the amount of fatigue, muscle fatigue, we can measure that. And we'll still get a longer post-reinforcement pause, even if the amount of fatigue or muscle strain or whatnot has been standardized. So it's not fatigue that causes longer post-reinforcement pauses, or causes post-reinforcement pauses at all, for that matter. Second possibility, satiation. I am just so full. I have been responding, and I've consumed this, and I just need to digest for a while. It's like, great. What if it's not food that's the reinforcer? Can you ever satiate on praise? Can you ever satiate on electrical brain stimulation of the pleasure center? You know, can you ever really satiate on glanding more dopamine to feel great? Probably not. And so we can do things there, or, you know, if you want to get a little more surgically tricky, you put a little tube into the dog's stomach, food goes down, food rolls out. It's like, yeah, I know, okay, fine. But in that case there, it's not satiation, right? You can't be satiating because there's nothing in your tummy except a tube leading out. Right, so we know it's not satiation. Best explanation is what's called the remaining responses hypothesis. This one says, look, the reinforcer, so respond, 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 get the reinforcer. And the reinforcer acts as a discriminative stimulus. Right? It says, hey, something different just happened here. We're now in a different state. Something just occurred. The reinforcer itself is a stimulus. Says, yep. And you know what? It's going to be a while before you can get the next reinforcer. Well, it's going to be however long it might take you before you can make enough responses to get it. The higher the schedule, then, the longer it's going to be, the longer the delay is before you can get the next reinforcer. Typically, you know, subjects work, you know, they're making the responses more or less as fast as they can there, so it's going to be a set sort of time. So you're not going to get the next reinforcer anytime soon. So, might as well take a little pause. At a higher schedule, it's definitely going to be a longer time, so taking a pause of a, you know, little break there isn't really costing you much in the sense. Have any evidence for this? Yeah, we do. Post-reinforcement pauses do increase as the fixed ratio size increases. Okay, so that doesn't really support satiation either there. Actually, in fact, that one goes directly against satiation because you should, the longer it takes you to get the more responses you make, the more the delay, the more you should have just digested what you had. Okay. But the way to look for the remaining responses hypothesis is to do kind of a little tricky design where we have multiple fixed ratio schedules running consecutively here. So we can have long and short schedules indicated by different discriminative stimuli. So we can tell the subject what it's going to be based on the stimulus here. So what we'll see here is something like this. We use a red light and a green light. So the green light indicates an FR10 schedule is coming up. Red indicates an FR40, so 10 or 40 responses. Our post-reinforcement pause is going to be longer if the next schedule coming is longer, shorter if the next one's short. And you know, this doesn't support fatigue in this sense. So if we look at this here, we've got a long post-reinforcement pause there. So we've just finished up our short red light. Oh, it's going to be long. Look, we had a long, long pause before we have to do all this. We finished that one. Green light comes on. Next one you got to do is going to be short. So we get a short post-reinforcement pause. But we just did 40 responses. If you were really fatigued by 40, you'd expect to have a long one following the a long pause following the long number of responses. We don't. look over here. We have a short one, then followed by a short one. So again, it's not even that we've got like a rhythmic pattern sort of going on here either. It's about looking at what you have to do next. Okay, so this fits with the remaining responses interpretation. Okay, fixed intervals. We do have a post-reinforcement pause in the fixed intervals, but it's categorically a different beast. All right, so in the post-reinforcement pause on your fixed ratio, due to your remaining responses, how much do you have to do before you can get the next reinforcer? On the interval, a set amount of time has to elapse. First response you make after that time has elapsed, that gets you the reinforcer. You can't bank your reinforcers. It's not like a fixed interval, 60 seconds. I'm just going to go to sleep, wake up 3 hours later, press the lever once, get hundreds of reinforcers. No. That would be lovely. It doesn't work that way. It's the first response after the time is up gets you that reinforcer. Clock doesn't reset until you make a response. And the next interval starts. So the reason that we have our post-reinforcement pauses on the interval, nothing to do with the remaining responses. It's just time estimation, right? It's like, you know, being in the family station wagon or van driving cross country to Toronto or something from Edmonton, you know. You don't start going, are we there yet? After you just clear the alley of your, you know, behind your house. Are we there yet? It's like, no, 4 days, you know. It's like, just get to Edmonton city limits here. Are we there yet? And it's like, no. You know, kids are annoying little creatures. Anyways, it's a time estimation, okay? There's no point for a subject to result. Say we got an FI 60 seconds. 60 seconds have to pass. There's no point responding, you know, like 2 seconds later, because it's like, well, that was a wasted response. And in fact, this is how we get this sort of scalloping effect to these, to the post-reinforcement pause there on the fixed interval, is the closer you get to the time, the more responses are made. And this makes sense. I mean, if I give you a watch and say it's an FI 60, boom, you've just gotten a reinforcer. You just look at the watch. You wait for 60 seconds. You know, 58, 59, 60. Boom! Damn, I'm good. One response got me the reinforcer. Whoop, whoop. Yeah, you got a stopwatch. I mean, yeah, you're great. You're cheating. Hey. If you don't have access to the watch, you got to do an internal time estimation, which means there's variation there. Now remember, the longer you wait after the time is up, that's lost time. That's time that you could have been getting another reinforcer in, right? If you can do it 60 seconds, bam, there you go. Clock starts in the next 60 seconds. If you wait 75 seconds, I want to make sure I only have to make one response there. Wait for 75 seconds. I'm sure 60 seconds has elapsed. Oh, great. But that doesn't put you 15 seconds closer, you know, to get in the next reinforcer. You just lost out. If you're only in the chamber for an hour, you just lost out on the total number of, you know, you could get 60 in an hour. Whoa, you wasted time. You get less than the 60 maximum of reinforcers possible. So you start responding before the interval is up. You don't respond early on. There's no point. Even, you know, even rats can figure out, I'm pretty sure it hasn't been 60 seconds yet. You know, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, 20 seconds on. They might start responding after 30 seconds, 40 seconds sort of thing. Go with that. Okay, so the minimizing the cost to benefit sort of thing here. The more you respond, the more energy you're putting into responding, the less benefit you're getting out of the reinforcers there. Variable ratio. Variable ratio, steady response patterns. You see this in gambling. Okay? Video lottery machines. Great example, lotteries. Great example of variable ratio. I could win the next time, but you probably won't. No, I'm sure I will. I've been standing in front of this video lottery machine all day putting money in. It's my run of luck is going to change. That's called the gambler's fallacy. No, you're just a sucker. Okay? I just don't trust VLTs because they got a computer chip in them. And I'm not saying that, like, you know, it's a whole Terminator thing where, you know, computers are going to take over the world and they're starting with VLTs. I mean, it's probably the way it's going to go. But anyways, that's not what I'm worried about. What I'm worried about is there's guys like me that instead of going to the light side, you know, of psychology, being like a Luke Skywalker, a Jedi, and teaching or doing therapy or dog training or whatever, they went the Darth Vader route. They went the Sith, right? And they're working for the gambling companies or, a drug dealer, a drug cartel or something. It's like, how can we make it even more addictive? Because I could make a really addictive video lottery machine if I wanted to, right? You got a computer chip in there. You can watch the chip can be monitoring people's response rate. Starts to slow down, give them a little reinforcer. I won something. They start up going faster again. Every time they start to slow down, heading towards extinction, let them win. All the law says is you have to have a certain percentage that is paid out. Doesn't say when you have to do the payout. And we're not allowed to take the VLTs apart to see exactly how they're working inside. That violates people's contracts with the VLT companies that make them. Only authorized service personnel allowed to work on them. But, I mean, psychologists that work for gambling companies that design stuff to make them more addictive. Variable ratio. We get a steady response pattern. It tends to be quite rapid. The more you respond, the more you can get. Okay, so we've got that. You never know if the very next response could be the one that gets you another reinforcer. Or maybe it's going to be a long stretch before you do. But you don't know until you try. So we tend to see high response rates. Post-reinforcement pauses, very unusual. You have to hit very high variable ratio schedules before they'll actually take a break. Because again, you might win the very next time. You might get a reinforcer the very next time you make a response. You sometimes get what's called ratio strain, again, but only at high schedules. And that occurs where you might take a break in the middle of responding. That probably is fatigue. Ratio strain, you see it in fixed ratios as well, but again, only on really high schedules. It probably is due to fatigue there. But generally, at sort of lower, more reasonable schedules, you tend not to see it. They just steadily respond away. Finally, the variable interval, randomly based on time. Now, in this case here, we don't see the post-reinforcement pauses that we do on the fixed interval because you never know when the time is going to be up. You know, if you got a variable interval 30 seconds, on average 30 seconds have to elapse before a response will get you the reinforcer, but could be 6 seconds, could be 94 seconds, could be 12 seconds. You don't know. So instead of taking long pauses and just going boop, I mean, what if it was like, set up so it was like, it'll happen after 3 seconds, after 13 seconds, after 20 seconds. What if you have a string of short ones there? If you go, I'm just going to wait like 45 seconds here. It's like, well, you lost out on a whole bunch of reinforcers there. So what you tend to get with VIs is sort of steady, slower, moderate response rate, every few seconds or so. Generally, the larger the VI schedule, the more time between responses at some point. We tend to get a slower response rate than on VR. It's variable again, but look, there's an upper maximum in terms of how much you can get. And that's not, in a ratio, the faster you respond, the more you get. In any interval schedule, if you're on a fixed interval 60 or a variable interval 60, in an hour, 60 seconds, in an hour, at best, you can get 60 reinforcers. Going faster doesn't get you any more. So there's no point. I've watched rats actually sort of like lay down. It's like, get a paw, on the lever. Da-da. Hey, I got something. Go over, eat it, come down, get comfortable, lay down. I'm going to use my left paw now. Hit the lever. It's like, it's very laid back. Okay. Let's take a look at some differences between, or make a comparison between our VR and VI. As we said, the response rate for your variable ratio faster than variable interval. We've talked about molecular and molar theories. Molecular theories of behavior is dealing with small-scale events. Okay, what is happening on a trial-by-trial basis? Do you get reinforced on this trial? How long did it take? How many responses did you have to make? Okay, so trial-by-trial. Responses, how many responses made? How much time passed? Boom, I responded, I got reinforced. Okay, that would be a molecular account. Small scale, molecules, small things. Molar theories, big teeth in the back of your mouth, okay, big things, large scale events. So not how many responses do you have to make on this trial, but say over the whole experimental session, like you're in the opera chamber for an hour that day, over the length of the whole session there, what did it sort of work out to be? What were your response rates? What was your how many reinforcers did you get? Okay, so we can look at this from a very different scale. Now, so different approaches to looking at the differences between VR and VI. The IRT, the inter-response time reinforcement theory. This is a molecular account of the difference between VR and VI. So this says, look, we got to look at the time between two consecutive responses, time. All right. On a VI schedule, this says that longer IRTs are more likely, longer IRTs are going to get reinforced. The longer you wait, the more likely it is that the clock's timed out, and there you go. On a VR schedule, time's irrelevant. Therefore, shorter IRTs are going to be reinforced. Now, I said this is a molecular theory. It's dealing with this trial by trial. But we have to look at this as well sort of in an acquisition. So it says, okay, during a learning period, subjects are going to start out kind of randomly. You know, they don't know what's going on. Dr. Snyder walking on the table at the end. I don't know what's going on. You're shaping me to do something. Okay, so there's variability in the behavior. So we're going to try some different things. They'll respond something a little faster, a little slower, whatnot. Different IRTs. Over a period of acquisition then, you know, so IRT is a molecular theory in that it's saying what happens trial by trial, but it has a little bit of a molar component to it in that the subjects sort of have to keep track of this over, you know, over the early learning period here. It says over this learning period, if you're on a VI schedule, just looking at this, more of your responses that came after a longer delay or longer pause are going to be reinforced. On a VR schedule, it's just going to happen that you're more likely to get a reinforcer just after you've waited a short period of time. You're sort of, if your brain is somehow keeping track of that, you're going to start shifting your behavior. You're being shaped, in essence. So I just ground this out the other night. I said, well, how can I show this to people? I was like, well, I'm just going to get a random number generator here. And so a little random number generator with a mean of 5. Okay, so the average is going to be 5. Set up so that it'll run 30 reinforcer deliveries. Okay, so just collected cases where 30 reinforcers went until I just had 30. Then I just randomly and said, okay, let's just run a different random number generator here for either the time or number of responses needed for reinforcers. So if we were doing on an interval schedule here, say it would be you've waited 8 seconds. So you have an IRT of 8 seconds. Then you wait 9 seconds before your next response. Then 5 seconds. Then 3, so on. That's what we're going to be interested. They're all based on time here, but this is going to be involved in showing you how we can get this difference. So it's the amount of time between responses. Okay, so 8 seconds, then the next one comes after 9, then 5, 3, 2, and so on. And I didn't type all of them out because I had a lot of them, right? Here's I'm getting a little bit flustered. Here's the time between responses. Okay. Here's the time or number for reinforcement. See, when I do minimal notes, I just come up with something off the top of my head late at night, I forget what I'm doing. Right, sorry. It really is. Time or number for reinforcement. Right, so this is the actual, so VI, so on the VI5 here, in this case here, 8 seconds had to pass. 9 seconds had to pass. 5 seconds. Okay, so 3 seconds, 2, et cetera, et cetera. On a VR, I've just used the same number here. So 8 responses are needed, then 9 responses are needed, then 5, then 3, then 2. Okay. Then, right, here's where I had, and I had 30 of these. Here's then what I did. I ran second set of random number generation in terms of just the time between responses. So here's the IRTs. So just randomly, the first time there was our hypothetical subject waited 1 second before it responded. Then wait another 3 seconds. Then 10 seconds. Now, on the interval, look, it's got to wait 8 seconds. So 1 plus 3 is 4. You know, 1 second. No, we haven't reached 8 yet. Another 3 seconds have passed. Total of 4. No. Wait 10 seconds. Well, we've now totaled 14 seconds. Well, 14 seconds is longer than 8. So, boom, we get a reinforcer delivered there. Okay? Now the clock starts again running 9 seconds. Okay, so 4 seconds. We wait. No. Another 1 second. 5, 6, 7. We wait 3 seconds. 8, 9, 10. Well, 10 is greater than 9. Boom. Another reinforcer is delivered on the interval. Then we have to wait 5 seconds. Well, waits another 8 seconds. Responds, yeah, the clock is timed out. Boom, another reinforcer. Okay. On the ratio bit, so 1 second, you know, waits 1 second, responds. So here's our first response, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth. Boom. After a 3 second, a 3 second IRT, we get our first reinforcer. Now we need 9 responses on the ratio here. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Our IRT of 5 seconds leads us. That's our 9th response. Boom, there we go. We need 5 responses now. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Boom, there we go. Okay. So confused? Making sense? I just represents the reinforcer for the interval schedule. And I'm sorry, an R represents getting the reinforcer for the ratio schedule. So, so this first line just shows if you're on an interval schedule using this in terms of seconds before you get how much seconds have to pass before you get reinforcers available. And these are the actual IRTs. Then after, you know, you need 8 seconds, so 1, 4, 10, well, 14 seconds have now elapsed. Boom, that would be our first interval, first reinforcer on the interval. Whereas with the number, so variable ratio, has to be 8 responses, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Boom, there we go. The ratio doesn't care how much time has passed, just how many responses are actually made. Okay. So we do this. And then I looked at all the IRTs here. So on the interval schedule, running for delivery of 30 reinforcers, here's what we find. There's just, I mean, you can see a slant here towards the higher IRTs. Just in this way, the longer you wait on an IRT, just the more likely the clock is timed out, the more likely your longer IRTs are to have a reinforcer come right after it. So we shape it. The longer you wait, it's like, oh, you waited longer. Bam, there we go. You get a reinforcer. Good rat. You know. Ratio, again, we can see there's a real skewing here towards the slower ones. The shorter IRTs. Okay, just because it means you get those responses done quicker, and you're just more likely to have a reinforcer coming after it. Okay. So, anyways, this just says that then during the acquisition, individual IRTs, either an individual IRT, a pause, either gets followed by a reinforcer or it doesn't. In interval sessions, you're just more likely to get longer IRTs that are followed by reinforcement. That shapes the subject to wait longer. Once you get that feedback going, it really exacerbates it and forces this faster and faster, so you get longer and longer IRTs built up pretty quickly. In the ratio, you could shape the other direction. Okay? Makes them shorter and shorter. So that's the one approach to this. A second approach is called the response reinforcer correlation theory. This one is a molar interpretation. It says the subjects keep a whole session, however long it is, an hour, 2 hours, whatever it is, the whole day, whatever it is. Part of the brain just keeps a sort of running tally. Some people really don't like this. They know it's got to be way too cognitive for a rat or a pigeon to do. I mean, you know, maybe a person, sure. Elitist. Hummingbirds have a stunning ability to keep track of these kinds of things. And hummingbirds have a really tiny brain. And in terms of looking at, you know, postulating the underlying neural circuitry to do this, it's really not that big of a deal. Okay? So I don't really buy the criticism that it's too cognitive on this one. What it says is you look at what happens over the long term here. So your response reinforcement relationship across the whole experimental session over the long range. So, you know, your first time you're in the box for the hour, you try this. If you're on a race, you respond really slowly. You don't get that much. You try responding a bit more the next time. Oh, yeah, over the session I got more. Oh, I should try responding a little faster even. So off you go. On the interval, right, the faster you respond, yeah, the more you get up to some point. If we've got a VI 60 over here, you know, the more you respond, if you respond too slowly, yeah, I mean, it's like, I'm going to respond once, you know, I'm going to make one response a minute. It's like, great, you know, you'll probably get a few reinforcers in the hour. You're lame, okay? If you respond more, a little faster here, you're much more likely to get more. But you're going to hit some maximum point. At some point, you can't get any more than the 60 reinforcers that are available for the hour. Ratio, the faster you go, the more you can get. Now, at some point, you're going to hit the physiological maximum in terms of a VR, right? At some point, you just can't press the lever any faster. So, yeah, at some point, this is actually going to flatline out, asymptote out. But really, up until that point, until your little wrist falls off or wears out, or you know, get some carpal tunnel syndrome, you bang away on the lever. The more you can go, the more you get. Okay. So it says trial by trial, doesn't matter what happens in each individual trial. It's the long term. So individual IRTs, not important. Over the long term, did you get more or less? Okay. So, I mean, in a sense, that's a choice. What are you going to do? Are you going to respond faster or are you going to respond slower? That's typically not how we study choice in the laboratory sciences. We typically do something that's really simplistic because, you know, laboratory psychologists go, ooh, the real world is tricky and difficult. All these confounds, they kind of, like, freak us out. You know, ethologists, on the other hand, you know, zoologists that study animal behavior go, that's what's so cool about it. The world is tricky and complicated. Let's see what happens. But psychologists, it's like, I start out in zoology, so I kind of like the idea of just going out someplace and just seeing sort of what happens. It's like, I don't know, what happens if I pour a whole bottle of maple syrup next to the ant colony? Let's find out. It's like, oh, look, you know, there are ants coming out. Oh, look, there's birds coming by to eat the ants. Oh, what's that going to do to the ants' behavior? It's complicated. It's like, yeah, it's fun. Anyhow, in the lab, at the minimum, what you need is two options for choice. And the easiest way to do it is to have two keys or two levers. Press left, press right. What you going to do? And the keys or levers are running on concurrent schedules of reinforcement. Now you can set them up ratio, VR5, VR10, right? So left lever on a variable ratio 5, right on a VR10. If you do ratio setups, it keeps pouring really quickly. The subjects, after you know, after a session or two, is go, oh yeah, on this one I have to respond a lot less to get reinforced than that other one. I'm never responding on the higher schedule ever again, and they stop. They'll just respond exclusively on whichever is the lower ratio. Okay, interval schedules though, you got to move back and forth between them, right, to get the maximum amount of reinforcement. You can't go, oh yeah, this is a fixed interval 5 on the left and a fixed interval 30 on the right. Wow, I don't get reinforced all that often on the right, so I'm just going to ignore it entirely. I'm just going to go with the 5. It's like, yeah, but you're losing out, you know, on potentially two reinforcers a minute by ignoring the right. And over an hour, that's a lot of reinforcers. So, yeah, I guess so. So on interval schedules, they'll have to toggle back and forth. Now, the question is, how are they going to do that? How do they partition their time, their responses? And that's the data that we're interested in. That's what we're interested in. We do use, very typically, on this, what are called CODs. If a subject is doing it wrong, we hit them with a COD. We used to use COD that we get from Newfoundland, but with the fish stocks being so low, we can't actually afford to do this anymore and smack rats with codfish. We've had to use things like burbot, and some people are using northern pike, but there's concerns about that. No. Clearly, sleep deprivation is driving me insane. No, CODs stand for change over delays. Okay, so a change over delay. What this means is it's a little penalty that we put in for switching too fast. One way that you can sort of, and psychologists call this, behavioral psychologists talk about this as cheating. I think it's actually very clever for a subject. To maximize on an interval-interval schedule, concurrent VI-VI schedule, a subject can actually get every reinforcer possible by just shuttling back and forth between the two keys really quickly. And psychologist goes, but they're not making a choice. It's like, yeah, they are. They're choosing to go back and forth really quickly. It's like, but it's like they haven't learned what the variable interval schedules are on the two, and they're not partitioning in a matching sort of way. It's like, uh-huh. But we want them to do that. I was like, oh, okay. We're putting some more constraints on the behavior. So to stop the subjects just from going left, right, left, got a reinforcer, right, left, right, left, got a reinforcer. To stop that frequent back and forth, they put the changeover delay in. Every time you change, because you've been working on the left, you go right, there's perhaps, say, a three-second penalty. In other words, let's just say there's a reinforcer waiting for you on the right. The clock is timed out. You come over, boom, you hit right. But if you only stay there for a second or two and then go back to the left, you didn't pass that three-second penalty. You didn't pass the three-second changeover delay. The changeover delay, the first response that is made after the delay is up. So the first response, you go right. Boom, first response starts the changeover clock. 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000. First response after the changeover clock is up, that counts towards the schedule that you're on. If there's a reinforcer waiting for you, then you get it. If there's no reinforcer waiting for you, well, then you just have to stay there longer and keep making some more responses, wait some more time. Okay? But if you're doing a really rapid back and forth shuttling, which actually is a way of maximizing your outcome here, but it's not generally what the laboratory psychologist wants, then you impose the changeover delay. You can do it with this little sort of tricky timing thing. You can also just put it in that there's like a barrier between it. So, you know, the left key, or you separate the keys. So, you know, if this was the operant chamber, you know, one key is on that wall, the other key is on that wall. And so it's going to take me a few seconds to go back and forth between the two of them. In other words, if I'm over pressing the lever on that side of the room, I got to be somewhat confident that there's a reinforcer, at least there's a possibility that a reinforcer is waiting over on the other option for me to want to walk across and do it. Okay, so by doing this, by putting a cost in place for changing, forces the subjects to be more cognizant, consider the actual VI schedules. Right. This led Herrnstein, doing this kind of stuff, led Herrnstein to formulate what he called the matching law. So the B stands for behavior or responses, but we use R for reinforcement. So we'll use B for behavior, in other words, the number of responses you make, and R for reinforcement. So B1, amount of behavior on choice 1, lever 1, key 1, whatever, divided by your total number of behavior. So B1 plus B2. So amount of behavior on 1, B1. Amount of behavior directed towards choice 2, B2. All these are doing is giving you a little proportional ratios here. So the amount of, this gives you a ratio here. So the amount of responding on 1 is what out of the total responses. On the right there, R1 divided by R1 plus R2, amount of reinforcement. So this would be the, so say in the case, course of an hour, depending on what your schedule was, you could get X amount of the total reinforcement from option 1 and Y amount of the total reinforcement from option 2. So it's the proportional rate of reinforcement. So on R1, on the amount of reinforcement coming from key 1 is 60% of the total. Say, okay, so we can get the proportional amount there. What the matching law says, and over here, this is just a simplification of it. I mean, the numbers will give you a slightly different number, but mathematically, if you don't want to actually, you know, add things like this, mathematically this will reduce down to give you exactly the same information. The numbers will be different, but you'll get the same, you can use it in the same way to determine if there's matching or not, so whatever.
I like the version on the left just because I just find it intuitively makes me think about that. I'm dealing with proportions out of the total there, but whatever. It doesn't really matter. Either way, if you've got subjects that are matching, that means they will spend, you know, if you can get 60% of your reinforcement from key one and 40% from key two, they match if they direct about 60% of their behavioral responses on key one and about 40% on key two. There's obviously a bit of wiggle room on this one. It's like, do they match only if it's an exact, like, 60-40, you know? What if it's, like, 57% on one and 43 on two? It's like, yeah, that's probably matching. That's within sort of a range of error there, okay? What if it's, like, 30% of the responses on one and 70% on two? It's like, yeah, no. They're not matching. Something's gone wrong. There's something happening. Then they have not achieved matching. Okay, so you can be a little bit off and still be treated as matching. If we're way off, we've got what's called bias. Okay, so in bias, we end up spending more time on one alternative than we'd otherwise predict. Now, there's a whole range of possible reasons for why. One possibility is side preferences. Humans... About 90% of people are right-hand dominant. 10% are left-hand dominant. Non-humans, they don't seem to have the kind of real bias in that way. But, I mean, rats. An individual rat is either right-paw dominant or left-paw dominant. If you look at all rats, it's about a 50-50 split. Same thing with monkeys. Monkeys are going to be either right-paw dominant, left-paw dominant. About half of monkeys are right-paw dominant. About half are left-paw dominant. In that sense. But you know, individual could have a real preference, would really rather reach with the right paw or the left paw. Pigeons? Well, they've only got one beak, so if they're pecking the key, we don't. But they could have visual issues of right eye or left eye dominant, and that could perhaps subtly change their response pattern. Dr. Hurd in the department, he used to do some very nice work with a Knoll lizard. He studies aggression. Interested in aggressive behavior. And he used to work with Knoll lizards. They're little lizards about yay big. They can turn brown. They can turn green. They sit in bushes and eat flies. That's kind of their existence. And they hold territory. Males will hold territory. If two males meet up on a vine or a branch or something in a bush, they'll and, you know, one's coming into the other's territory, they will fight. Big sort of, you know, fight with. What does that involve? You know, like some sort of massive Godzilla throwdown fight? No, they head bob. But they just like fighting for those is like, who can bob their head higher? And they'll just like do little push ups. And it's like, oh, my head is going up and down. Whoever can make the higher sort of and more vigorous one is probably the tougher, stronger, you know, more boss lizard. And so the other goes, whoa, you're scary, and leaves. Or I'll stick my tongue at you, you know, that sort of thing. It turns out that because of the way the neural circuitry in the brain runs, I can't remember which eye it is, I've forgotten. I think it is that if they look at another lizard, predominantly if they turn their head, because their eyes are back on the side, they don't have full binocular vision. So, which is why if they're looking to try to grab a fly or something, they'll go back and forth a little bit or up and down so they can get a stereoscopic effect that way, called parallax. But I think it's if they see things with the left eye, they're less aggressive. Just the way the input comes in and what it does in terms of cortical steroids in these little lizards and adrenal glanding, they gland less adrenaline. So if they're really concerned about their territory, they'll look with the right eye. And then they're like a hyper-aggressive lizard. Big head bobs up and down. So side preference. Okay. So we get into some weird little things like this. So we could have something like that happening. There could just be biological predispositions in terms of behavior patterns, response patterns, reflexive types of things there. And, you know, you control for those with different species, subjects you're working with. Okay. What's more interesting are changes in quality and amount. Now, I mean, we could talk about, you know, we can change the schedule, so VI 5 seconds, VI 13 seconds on our different choices. But we can play with other stuff. It's like, okay, so VI 5, VI 13, but what if we make the quality of the reinforcer on the VI 13 really good? Right, so on the VI 5, we give you some like leftover Halloween candy, the waxy kind of stuff. Not very good stuff, you know. On the VI 13 lever, we're going to give you like Cabot chocolate, like really good chocolate instead, higher quality. Sure, you're not getting as much because it's a VI 13 schedule versus a VI 5, but it's like really good chocolate, so. Maybe you buy it. It's like, yeah, I didn't really care if I'm eating this waxy stuff that's been left over and it's stale and it's no longer sort of brown color of chocolate. It's been left since Halloween. It's kind of turned that white. Nobody else keeps chocolate around that long for Halloween. Just, okay, well, anyways. Right? It's like, icky chocolate, so go with this. I'm biased towards the good stuff. But wait, maybe we could change them out, too. It's like, okay, so yeah, we'll give you, on the VI-13, we'll give you some Bernard Cabot chocolate, which is really good. But we'll only give you one, you know, we'll only give you 1 gram of it. Whereas on the, we're talking about rats here, okay? So 1 gram is a lot for a rat. On the VI-5, you can get it more often. It's not very good, but we'll give you 6 grams of it. So we'll change the amount. Okay, and then you see, we're starting to really complicate things here. And sometimes you go, oh, what am I doing here? Now, once we get into that, once we start changing quality and amount, and this is very real-world sort of stuff, right? You know, go looking for a car. Which car should you buy? Like, this one's got better fuel economy, but it's more expensive, and its crash test rating isn't as good. This one's not as good on fuel. It's got really good safety, and it's in the color I want. This other one, okay. Now, this is where we get into these sort of real-world choices, and we're faced with all these different changes, you know, differences in terms of quality, amount, schedule, all of this stuff, right? So we can simulate that in the model system in the laboratory as well, right? So we can produce biases. All we mean by biases is it moves away from the strict matching law. We don't get the match. And all the matching law does in its basic form that I showed you there initially, going back to this, the basic form, all it looks at is responses and the rate of reinforcement determined by the schedule. So if we don't get matching, we say, oh, you know, there's something, there's a bias going on here, something happening. We can also call this either undermatching or overmatching. We'll come back to that in a minute. We can adjust Herrnstein's basic matching. This is, in fact, the full, you know, here's the full matching law. Okay. So we put in some constants that represent amount and quality. So A for amount, Q for quality. And so quality, Q1, quality of the first reinforcer, Q2, quality of the second reinforcer, A1, amount of the first reinforcer, A2, the amount of the second reinforcer. If we have a standardized, so there's the same amount on both reinforcers and the quality, you know, it's like, and on key one, you get one piece of rat chow. On key two, you get one piece of rat chow. It's the same number, and it's the same type of rat chow. Then our A's and Q's just all go to one. They're constants. Just one, 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 one. And they drop out, and we're back to, on the right, R1 divided by R1 plus R2. But if there are differences, we can say, okay, does this explain why we've deviated from our basic B1, B2, our B1 over B1 plus B2 equal to R1 divided by R1 plus R2. If we start playing around with these, can we, you know, put in some measures for how perhaps the quality of their mount is different? Can this bring it back into matching? Does this explain why, you know, we've got a subject responding more on the VI-13 than we'd expect just based upon it being VI-5 versus VI-13? Okay, so we can play with that. Now, admittedly, this is a little bit clunky. This wasn't really what Herrnstein was primarily interested in. Theoretically, this works just, I mean, theoretically, it's like, yeah, you make some estimates of what the quality of the amount are. There you go.
So it works. You know, I mean, conceptually it works just fine. One of his students, Baum, got very interested in specifically issues of bias. And Baum talked about what he called undermatching or overmatching. Undermatching is the most likely thing that's going to happen with bias. In this case, your response proportions are going to be less extreme than the reinforcement proportions. You can also get what's called overmatching. Here, the response proportions are more extreme than the reinforcement proportions. This is rather rare. It's found if he found it if he put a really large COD, a really large changeover delay, in place. But it doesn't happen all that often. So he put like a really big barrier between his keys that like really long run, you know, sort of end run around something. In which case, they just went, I'm just going to staple it. You know, I know I'm losing reinforcers by not going over to the side, but holy smokes, I gotta run all the way around and go over there and come all the way back again. I can afford to lose a few. Okay. So the way Baum, and so Baum gets interested in this, and Baum goes, oh, you know, I can do this with Herrnstein's, you know, my supervisor's equation there with, you know, the A's and the Q's and whatnot, but it's a bit of a pain in the tuchus. He said, I'm going to just kind of reformat things. Just to give you an idea, in terms of undermatching, you sort of look at this here. What you do is you the way Baum started this, so he said, you know, plot out your behavior, your proportional rate of behavior for one choice, and your proportional rate of reinforcement for your that choice there. Graph them out here, standardized between 0 to 1, and, well, it's going to be. He said you'll have undermatching if you've got, you know, if you collect data from a whole bunch of different, you've got to have a whole bunch of different, you know, subjects running a whole bunch of different schedules. So cases where your R1 divided by R1 plus R2 gives you 0.5, you know, R1 divided by R1 plus R2 gives you 0.6, etc. So you got to do a whole bunch of groups on this. But you get undermatching if you get something like this. If it was, you know, a perfect matching situation, you'd have this beautiful 45-degree diagonal line going on. It says in this case here, there, if you get a data plots that followed sort of this red curve, they're going to be scattered because of the individual variation. But you get that, it's what's called undermatching. You're closer towards essentially just chance. Overmatching, you get something that looks a little bit more like this. And it's pretty unusual to get this one. Okay, we're not going to worry too much about the details there. To sort of use Herrnstein's equation, you've kind of got to look at it like this. You got to kind of graph it and plot it out. And this bothered Baum. It's like, this is a lot of work. He made a choice, essentially. He said, I'm going to reformat the entire equation just to make this easier for me. So Baum took and changed it around. He said, okay, we'll do the B1 divided by B1 plus B2 equals small b times R1 divided by R2 in bracket to the S power. You go, oh, Baum, you crazy guy. Well, what was kind of crazy was Baum said, and I'm going to call it Baum's magic law. Bit of advice. If you go on for grad school and you've got a supervisor who's got something named after him or herself, don't redo it and name it after yourself until you graduate. Apparently, Baum and Herrnstein didn't really speak very much after this. that I don't know if that's just the story that, you know, I was told when I was in grad school. Maybe it was just a warning. You know, this could be an urban legend about this, that supervisors tell all their students, you know, don't be like Baum, because then we'll have bad relations and you'll fail. I'm not sure. Anyways, but that's the story I was told when I was a grad student. Notice I've never named anything after myself. Snyder's Law of Procrastination. Probably the best I could get. So Baum's interested, though, in issues of bias. And this works a lot better for him. So he says, right, if you're interested in issues of bias, you know, let's redo it this way. So the S stands for the sensitivity of the behavior relative to the rate of reinforcement. And as I said, in the old way, you kind of got to graph all this out and look at it here. But in this case here, you know, you've got perfect match. If you've got perfect match, okay, S essentially drops out of the equation, 1.
If S is set to 1, anything raised to the power of 1 is, well, just what it was. You know, that exponential doesn't matter. It's gone. So that's got perfect matching. And if that happens, so if the S is gone, this starts to look back to the slight simplification, B1 divided by B2 equals R1 divided by R2. Okay? Not R2, D2, different situation. Okay? So if that's 1, we're heading back towards Hernstein's original version here. If S is less than 1, you can make things balance here. So you say, okay, it's not balancing. It's B1 divided by B2, R1 divided by R2. We're not matching. The sides aren't balancing. If you put in a exponential number here that's less than 1, and you can cause it to match up this way, we say, ah, we've got undermatching. If the only way you can get the sides to balance is by putting in an S value greater than 1, overmatching. Okay? Exactly, does the same thing as doing this, right? It's just, in some ways, a lot easier to deal with the numbers like this. And most people do it this way at this point, right? Because it's just like, why not? You're just looking at a single parameter there. It's an easy sort of number to keep in mind. What about the B? B represents what's called response bias. And that could be due to all kinds of things. Side preferences, biological predispositions, differences in terms of motivation for a particular type of reinforcer, these sorts of different types of reinforcers for subjects, these kinds of things. You kind of need to empirically know a little bit about that. You either have to work with, again, if you work with rats or pigeons or gerbils or mice, you check the literature, and you're using sort of standard reinforcers of, mouse chow or rat chow or little bits of chocolate or whatnot. For pigeons, grain, these sorts of things, water. You go back through the literature, you can get estimates of what B is likely to be already. So you don't. But if you want to start working with, like, wombats, you got to run a bunch of background tests to try to figure that one out. Okay? But once you've got your value for response bias, you can find out. Another way, of course, to do it is you pick things that you know, there's our B1, or B1, B2, that's our behavior. We know what our R1 is, we know what R2 is. We've set it so there shouldn't be a side, you know, any sort of side preference here for differences in amount or whatnot. So S should drop to 1, and then you can solve for B as well, get an estimate that way. But still, you sort of have to do empirical measures there. Okay, so your textbook goes through the details there. Your textbook also shows you a sort of breakdown of how can a case of where you only have one choice, you know, one key, you know, how can that actually be choice? Do you have a choice? Yeah, the choice is you either press this or you don't. Right? Your textbook takes you through that. You can read through that one on your own. What I want to talk a little bit about here is some theories of choice. So why? Why do we choose stuff? One possibility is that matching. It's just like the matching law just explains this, right? It's like animals, you know, sometimes why do you try to match? Why do you partition your responses proportionately with your reinforcers? And Hernstein said, well, maybe because animals are just kind of evolved to do it this way. So Hernstein, and then he said, but no, that's not it. So he rejected his own. So good for him. It's like, you know, I did this thing called the matching law. Maybe that's just the way we've evolved. He said, but no, that's not right. But it's worth considering. It's like, well, maybe we've just evolved to match because we've got some little sort of neural architecture in there that does the equivalent of balancing these two sides of the equation. It's nice. Seems a very simple approach. Doesn't actually work. Consider a VR-VR schedule. As I said, what will really happen is your subject will just pick, after a little while of playing around with it, it's just going to exclusively choose one alternative. And it's going to pick whichever one is lower. It's going to pick you've got a VR5, VR8, it's going to pick the VR5. It will just stop responding to the VR8 because it can just get more reinforcers on the VR5. You can't actually explain that with the matching law. The matching law can't tell. The matching law says, well, you know, you could go exclusively to the VR5 or you could go exclusively to the VR8. It's like, yeah, but they don't. They only go to the lower. So matching law can't actually, you can balance the matching law either way. Okay? So matching can't explain this. The matching law doesn't explain it. So we're not matching. We're not doing this choice because somehow we evolved a neural architecture that's structured just around Hernstein's matching law. Second idea here, it's called amelioration theory. It says you invest your effort into the best alternative. Best in quotation marks, okay? Now, on a VIVI schedule, that means that you have to partition your responses so that you get the best reinforcer response ratio, which means you're going to have to screw around this for a while. Screw around this, technical term there, okay? You're going to have to try some stuff out. We talked about feedback systems before, right? So we talked about comparators, right? So you're going to start going one way here. You're going to overshoot your goal, okay? So things are going well, things are going well. You seem to be getting a good amount. Oh, you respond too much, okay, on one side over the other. And so you go, oh, you know, I responded a bit more on the left key than the right today. Yesterday I responded less on the left, so I'm getting more reinforcers today. I'll try responding even more on the left tomorrow. Oh, I'm getting less reinforcers today than I did the day before. So you feedback. It's like, okay, let's try this again. Let's respond a bit a bit more on the right the next day. And somehow, eventually, you get into this sort of balance where you achieve the best. And what this means is you'll have to respond to both choices on a VIVI schedule. You'll eventually discover that the total number of the total number of reinforcers you get is going to be highest by somehow partitioning, you know, getting whatever the partition is of behavior to the two choices. But you'll take a while to toggle around and figure out what that is. On a VRVR schedule, says what's going to happen is you're going to keep shifting towards the lower schedule. So I'm just going to randomly do something the first day, the next day, so I'm going to respond more on this one here. I'm going to get a little bit more that way. I'm going to respond a little more on the lower schedule, a little more. I'm going to respond exclusively on the lower schedule. That maximizes the amount of reinforcers I get. This is an interesting theory because it mixes both molecular and molar interpretations. Most theories are pretty much either a molar or a molecular account of things. This is kind of a mix. Look, you got to find out what's happening over the long run, but you've also got to be somewhat cognizant of your trial by trial responding. Changing the trial by trial can shift your balance of behavior around here. So this sort of involves both. Optimization theory has been another approach here. It says this one's very much just a molar account. It says you're going to optimize your reinforcement over the long term. So what you want to do here, minimum work, maximum gain. You want to expend the least amount of energy to get the most. Now, on a VIVI schedule then, to get the most reinforcers, you have to go back and forth between them. That's how you get the most over the long run. What about something like bounds over matching when you put a really big barrier in there? Well, in that case, you're getting such a huge cost for switching. It's like, yes, if the barrier wasn't there, I should go back and forth between them, partition my time in a particular way between the two choices. But every time I switch, there's a really big cost. There's a really big penalty. It may actually be more optimal for me to forego many of the reinforcers from one of the choices because this minimizes the expenditure of energy, the cost of that changeover delay, the going around the barrier or having a really big changeover delay. So this works as well. Optimization can account for this too. Now, again, it's a molar interpretation. So, again, for psychologists that have qualms about the cognitive capacity of the non-humans to keep track of this stuff, they may not like optimization theory. Now, there's a whole branch of biology called behavioral ecology, and behavioral ecologists actually do pretty much everything based on optimization theory. They look at the cost-benefit analysis of whatever it is. They look at the energy into the system, energy out of the system of organisms' behaviors. And they're showing that even down in insects, insects can do a lot of this cost-benefit analysis. So, you know, some critiques of optimization in terms of the cognitive load that may hypothetically be put onto a rat or a pigeon or a gerbil, I don't really buy that, okay? Because ants can make some pretty impressive cost-benefit analyses, at least according to behavioral ecologists. The momentary maximization theory is, in this case, a molecular theory. So you're going to select the alternative that's got the highest value at this particular moment in time. So you got to look at, it says you're doing short-term benefits as opposed to long-term benefits. So by responding in this particular way right now, so I'm responding on, we got a VI, I don't care, VI, VI 10, VI 30. Okay, so I'm responding over the side of the VI 10. Okay, well, right now, you know, so like 5 seconds have passed, I'm more likely to get a reinforcer coming from the VI 10 schedule. Keep going, 10 seconds pass, get the reinforcer. Okay, the other one's a VI 30. Now, I could shift. It's possible that it's timed out, but it's perhaps still more likely that I'm going to get another reinforcer on the VI 10 before the VI 30 is timed out here. So right now, it's best for me to stay. So I stay put on the VI 10, short term. But I stayed here 20 seconds. You know, let's just say I've got it. Okay, now it's getting more and more likely that the VI 30 is timed out. At some point, the most likely thing that's going to give me the next reinforcer is switching sides. So my short term, and let's even say I stay on the VI-10 for another segment here. By this point, it's probably really likely that there's a reinforcer. I mean, it's not a guarantee, but pretty good chance that I'm more likely to get a reinforcer on the 30 than staying here, sticking around on the 10. Switch. Respond there till you get the reinforcer on 30. It's like, okay, now, where am I most likely to get my next reinforcer? It's possible on the 30, you know, another one could be just waiting here, but it's more likely it's going to be by shuttling back over to the 10. So momentary maximization says, you know, we're not doing this by looking at the long-term payoffs here. You're optimizing. It says just like right here, right now, what's going to get me the next reinforcer? Yeah. Well, you'd have to have some sort of, the question is, can't keep track of that unless you're keeping track of the long term. You would have to have at least learned that you've got, like, say, a VI 10, VI 30, and that's probably going to take some sort of more of a long term comparison. But once you've got that, and typically when we do these kinds of choice studies, so like Herrnstein's 1961 study that looked at this, he did 17 days of training with his pigeons in the different schedules that he had set up, and then he tested over the last 3 days. And so, I mean, the pigeons had figured this stuff out. So they asymptotically maxed out on, they learned what the schedules meant. So the question then is like, okay, you figured out, you know, yes, there has to be some sort of analysis that lets the subject figure out the differences between your schedules. But assuming you got that, then when we talk about the theory of how you make your choice in terms of do you stay on this one or that one, the assumption is that the subjects have at least learned the differences between the schedules by this point. And then once they've got that, what motivates them to go back and forth and spend their time? So, yeah, in that sense, the acquisition is always going to have to take a bit of a longer view there. But then in terms of why did you just shuttle? Why did you go from the left to the right then? You can take a look at this on a trial by trial. And that's what the momentary maximization does. It looks at it in terms of a trial by trial. There's also the delay reduction theory. There's a lot of theories on this. You can either get immediate or delayed reinforcement here. This one brings in basic principles of Herrnstein's matching law, and it says, and your choice is going to be directed towards whichever alternative gives the greatest reduction in the delay towards the next reinforcer. In other words, what's going to leave you sitting around twiddling your thumbs the least? This is another combined molar and molecular theory. It says we've got we're going to have to match our response to reinforcement. Yeah, so that's our matching law. And we're going to bring in a sort of trial-by-trial, kind of like back to our momentary maximization issue of the shorter delay. So should I stay or should I go? Which is going to reduce the amount of time until I get my next reward? Because, you know, nobody likes waiting. The sooner you can get it, the happier you're going to be. Okay, so that involves then a molecular component. My point here has not been to take you through a bunch of experimental results, trying to analyze these theories. That's really, I think, something for, you know, a 400-level course that grinds you through hundreds of data points of pigeon behavior. My point is to show you, or what I wanted to try to show you, with just giving you a sort of capsule view of the fact there's these different theories. And your textbook goes into some details about two or three of these more. So take a look at that, obviously. But what I sort of want to get you thinking about is issues of molar and molecular interpretations, how they don't have to be one or the other, how it could be a very combined sort of situation, and how if you start looking more in the literature, reading the literature, you can find that you know, thinking about theories, different theories may have support for them. Multiple theories may seem potentially all to have some weight. Now, what that suggests in terms of the study of behavior is we don't have the theory down yet, right? We haven't figured it out. There's still something else going on. We haven't managed to unify these theories. So keep that in mind. Last section in Chapter 6 takes a look at self-control. And, again, in this sense, self-control issues are about choice as well. You get into a conflict between your short and long-term choices. What's good for you in the long term may not be what's good for you in the short term, or vice versa. So the way we typically talk about self-control, sort of a simplistic definition, is if you're given a choice between a small, immediate reward or a larger, delayed reward, self-control would be picking the larger, delayed reward. Breakdown in self-control is when you go for the small, immediate. Okay? So you forego the larger payout, but you have to wait for it. Self-control is a lot easier if you set up a case where the reinforcer that you can get sooner does have a delay to it. So, you know, I should have put scare quotes around the immediate there. So if there's a bit of a delay to it, by adding a bit of a delay in, this makes, you know, so you can either get this, you know, soon, or this bigger thing, but you have to wait a bit longer. So if it's not quite the case where you can get it, bam, right now, but you've got to wait a little while at least, makes it easier to wait. The other thing is if you make it harder to get the task that you have to do to get the smaller but more immediate, let's say more immediate reward, if you make the task, make the job, you make the response more difficult, then waiting for the larger but more delayed reward becomes a lot more appealing. And again, that suggests that we've got some sort of much more molar optimization of cost-benefit analysis going on here. A few ways to look at this. Your textbook talks to you about the value discounting function of self-control. So it says to look at what you're going to choose. Are you going to pick the smaller but more immediate, or the larger, more delayed? So we're going to talk about the value of the reinforcer. Let's consider, what value does the reinforcer have? M indicates the reward magnitude, so the actual how much of it there is, let's say, or how good is it. K is called a discounting rate parameter. That one you have to generate empirically. It's like with time, how quickly does the sort of magnitude, the magnitude of a reinforcer drop off? Look at it this way, you know. Got a basket of fruit, you know. Maybe it's not quite ripe. Gets ripe. Wait too long. It's just mold. Okay, so there's going to be some different fruit will ripen and then rot at different rates. Okay, so your K value, you kind of got to empirically get that one there. D represents the reward, the delay before you get it. So let's just play with this a little bit here. So let's say we'll set the magnitude of a reward at 10, and we'll set K equal to just 5. Okay. So let's have two rewards. We'll have the rewards being equal. So it's the same magnitude. You have 10 units of reward in either case. But in the first case, we'll set our delay equal to 0. No delay, you got right now. Or in the second case, we'll set delay at 10. So if we do it with 0, so V equals M divided by 1 plus K times D, well, K is 5, D is 0, 5 times 0 is 0, so M here is 10, so 10 divided by 1 equals 10. Woohoo! The value of the reinforcer with no delay is 10 units of whatever value. Okay, it's kind of like we're scoring a wagon here. It's like, oh, what's a unit of associative strength? Yeah, it's just a unit. Okay, so 10. If we've got a delay of 10 units of time, okay, so M equals 1 plus 5, so K is 5 times 10, or 10 divided by 51. Look at the value of that reinforcer. It's like 0.2. You got a choice. You can either get this 10 magnitude reinforcer right now, or you can wait and get this 10 magnitude reinforcer 10 units of time from now. But the value of this thing right now is 10, whereas if I wait, the value is pretty much effectively 0. Yeah, why would you wait? Okay, if the magnitude is the same, there's no reason why you would wait. You would take the immediate. But what if the reward size is different? So let's change something. Let's take a situation here where we have a magnitude of 5 and a K of 5 delay of 1. So 5 divided by 1 plus 5 times 1, or 5 sixths. So our value here is 0.83. Well, let's say, okay, let's make a larger reward though. Let's put a delay in place. We'll put a delay of 5 in, but let's double the value of the reward. Maybe you'll wait for that. Okay, so magnitude 10. 10 divided by 1 plus 5 times 5. 10 divided by 26 is like, oh, look at that. It's got a greater value than our last, you know, our previous page's example here, but it's only like 0.385. It's only about half its value of this immediate, even though, you know, so I mean, here's the problem with the self-control breakdown. You know, the magnitude, even though there's twice as much of it in terms of the value, it's still a much lower value. Equal your value. So in this case here, the reason why, you know, to get to a case where it's like, what's it going to take to make you delay? What's it going to take to let you, to make you wait? We'd have to have a magnitude of, on our second option here, our delayed option, 21.66. Okay, so it has to be over 4 times as good. It's like, all right, you give me a reward that's over 4 times as good as this immediate one, I'll wait for it. Okay? So things like dieting, it's like, yeah, I'd really like to lose some weight this summer. You know, sure, in the long term, I know that's good for me. It's healthier, you know, I'll look less like a pear, that sort of thing. But that chocolate cake is a pretty high immediate value for me. You gotta really make, you know, the magnitude of my looking less pear-like really impressive. means you probably have to do something about my hair, my lack of financial, you know, success, and the fact that Brad Pitt and is probably just always going to look better than I do. Anyways, okay, so, I mean, these can be the challenges. Why is it hard to maintain self-control? Because as soon as you put a delay in to get the same kind of value to the reinforcement, it's got to be really high magnitude. Yeah?
So does this theory of self-control compete with, executive function theories? Where they say that it's, like, it's prefrontal cortex.
Oh. Well, they're pretty much completely different approaches, but... Yeah, so in that sense, they're kind of different. But I think you could probably take these cognitive theories and fit it with this. You'd have to start saying, okay, how is your executive function weighing the magnitude? So then there'd have to be some sort of weighting to these terms in terms of this is just saying we have some magnitude, however it's generated, whatever it is. Your executive function would come in and say, okay, so what's going to make the magnitude? What's going to make being thinner? You know, how reinforcing is that? So perhaps that's where the executive function comes in. Okay, we're done for the day. We'll see you next time. Next class, I've got the midterms. I just got the grades back like this morning. I've been teaching all day. I haven't had time to post them. I will try to get the grades up onto the website tonight. I will bring them along on Thursday. And I don't think there's anything here after class on Thursday. So if you run to the end of class, I'll bring things in. If we've got some time before the end of class, we can go through the exam at the end of the key up. Okay, so we'll see you on Thursday there. And if anyone doesn't have one of Carolyn's cards and you want one, there's a card up there.